Good morning, my friends, and welcome to yet another installment of Weekend Update. From high above all other puerile and insipid forms of Wyoming mainstream media, this is Cowboy State Politics. I, of course, am your illustrious host, David Iverson. Firmly ensconced behind the silver Cowboy State Politics microphone and broadcasting to you from the base of the Bighorns in beautiful Buffalo, Wyoming. Good morning, my friends, and welcome to the program. Today marks 2 weeks since the end of the 2023 legislative session. There's been a flurry of activity in the governor's office, signing bills, vetoing bills, letting bills become law without his signature. There is, however, been one subject area that's noticeably absent from his list. Of the numerous bills concerning Wyoming education that were filed this session, virtually none of them made it to the governor's desk. That is, with the exception of Senate File 133, the Eligibility in Interscholastic Sports Bill. Essentially, it's the same thing as last year's Fairness in Women's Sports Act. And while it came out of the legislative branch, heavily amended, Governor Gordon did allow it to become law without his signature. Other than that, there weren't any bills that made it out of the legislature concerning Wyoming education, except, of course, for some various funding measures. This ought to be kind of surprising to you, considering that nearly all of our legislators have children, and a great number of them have grandchildren. You would think that what happens in Wyoming schools would be top of the agenda for those folks. But out of the numerous bills that were filed concerning education in Wyoming, it was only Senate File 133 that made it all the way through. There were two bills that would ban transgender surgeries for minors. There were at least three bills that would stop pornography from being available to Wyoming students inside Wyoming school libraries. There were two bills that would have codified parental rights in education. One of those was summarily killed. The other was stuck inside Redcoat Speaker of the House Albert Somers' drawer and would never see the light of day. That's one of them that you saw all of those news articles about. Indeed, my friends, for a bunch of people that voted to give themselves two raises, they sure didn't do anything for your children. To give you an idea of how big of a failure this is, the Wyoming Constitution is one of the few in the country that specifically says the state will provide a free education to all children within the boundaries of the state of Wyoming. But it goes much farther than that. None of us should be surprised that our legislators just read the headline and forgot to scroll down and read the rest of the article. Article 7, Section 20 says, and I quote, "As the health and morality of the people are essential to their well-being and to the peace and permanence of the state, it shall be the duty of the legislature to protect and promote these vital interests by such measures for the encouragement of temperance and virtue, and such restrictions upon vice and immorality of every sort as are deemed necessary to the public welfare." That's not some obscure passage that I'm referring to. Those two sections are only a quick 2.5 pages apart in the same article of the Constitution, the one entitled Education. There were several bills that would have fit neatly into that category, yet none of them made it to the floor to debate. Fascinating. To say that none of these bills made it to the floor to debate is a little misleading. You see, it wasn't for lack of trying. Albert Somers refused to refer many of them to a committee. The most prominent of which was Senate File 117, the Parental Rights in Education Bill. Senate File 117 is one that had several articles in the national media written about it. There was a piece in the Washington Examiner and at least two of them on the Blaze. There was even an attempt on the floor to sidestep the Speaker of the House and get that bill to a committee so that it could be debated. That motion failed 34-27. There were 34 people in the House of Representatives that refused to even talk about codifying parental rights in education. Those people who refused to even talk about it are, Allred, Berger, Brown, Byron, Chadwick, Chestick, Burkhart, Clouston, Conrad, my own representative, Barry Crago, Steve Harshman, Bill Henderson, Lloyd Larson, J.T. Larson, Martha Lawley, Sandy Newsom, Nicholas, Nemec, Northrop, Oakley, Obermuller, O'Hearn, Olson, Provenza, Sherwood, Stiff, Storr, Walters, Western, Wiley, Yin, Zwanitzer, and his dad, Dave Zwanitzer, and then, of course, Redcoat Speaker of the House, Albert Sommers. The ultimate question in all of this is, why are they so scared to say that parents are the ultimate authority in their children's education? Well, the answer is obvious, my friends. The Teachers Union, the Wyoming Education Association. Speaker Sommers has been on the side of the Wyoming Education Association in nearly every single case during his political career. Those bills that he couldn't keep in his drawer, like Senate File 117, he sent to the Appropriations Committee to be summarily killed. The best example of that is Senate File 144, Anthony Bouchard's Chloe's Law. The first question you should ask is, why would he send a bill about education to a committee whose sole purpose is to spend money? Well, it's because he stacked that committee with the most liberal members of the Wyoming House of Representatives. Its chairman, Bob Nicholas, votes with the Democrats 86% of the time. There are only five members of the House of Representatives more liberal than Nicholas. They're all Democrats. So if you can't keep a political hot potato in your drawer, send it to the most liberal committee you have so that they can kill it. Well, sensing this was going to be the outcome concerning education in this year's legislative session, I set up an interview with a couple of ladies from an organization called Parents Defending Education. Basically, it's an outfit that's a resource for parents who are confronting things like critical race theory, gender ideology, social-emotional learning, diversity, equity, inclusion, and all of those code words for indoctrination that they're confronting with their children's education. We recorded it approximately 2 weeks before the end of the session, so a lot of the media firestorm you saw hadn't even happened yet. In other words, now that all of these numbskulls in Cheyenne have done nothing to address your concerns with your children's education, what can you do about it? Here's my interview with Maylene Salaberria and Alex Nestor from the organization Parents Defending Education. All right. Joining me this morning is Maylene Salaberria, hope I got that right, and Alex Nestor from Defending Education. Welcome to Cowboy State Politics.
Hi, David. Thank you for having us in the show today.
Thanks for having us.
So what I'd like to do first is just have you talk about your organization, what it is, what your mission is, what you guys do.
We have Parents Defending Education. That's our 501c3 nonprofit, and it's a national grassroots organization of parents and advocates working to reclaim our schools from political activism. We also have our new 501c4 side, PDE Action, that's working to do the same, but through legislation and state laws.
We are basically boots in the ground with parents all over the country. We are, like Alex said, a nationwide organization with teams and connections with parents groups and education advocates all over the country, including Alaska and Hawaii.
Well, Maylene, since I've got a microphone in front of you, when I first met you, you told me a story of moving here from Cuba and what your experience was like when you first got here. Could you tell me about that again?
I don't know. Do you want the long version of the story or the short one?
Well, what you had mentioned to me is that you lived in a country where you saw all of these socialist things happening.
Exactly. So, and it's one of the things that I think that makes me so passionate about this work that I do. It's basically, David, because I am the proverbial child of the state. There is nothing that is happening in the public schools in the United States today that I haven't seen and lived in my own life during the 27 years that I live in Cuba, where education was completely controlled by the government and where, the whole idea of the assaulting of parental rights and destroying the family unit was just the number one priority for that so-called free education system.
And so then you moved here, and what did you find out?
I know, isn't that the sweetest irony, with huge quotes around it. I think it would be very, very a contradicting result that I left my life in Cuba 22 years ago with two suitcases and $200 in my pockets for my American-born children to end up in the same indoctrination mill that I have to escape from. So yeah, that's one of the reasons why, you know, what is happening with our schools nowadays and the battle to reclaim public education is the hill where I will happily die on.
So Alex, how did you get involved in parental rights?
So after I graduated college, I wrote for the Washington Free Beacon for a couple years, and I covered education. And more than that, too, both of my parents are teachers. My mom has taught in public schools for nearly 30 years. My dad taught in private schools and now works for a charter school, and he's been doing that for around two decades. So it's an issue that hits very close to home. And a lot of these conversations that we're having today, specifically regarding administrators and their support for teachers and the different types of things that they push onto a classroom, these are conversations that I've had around my dining room table since I was a little girl. So it's a very important issue to me and my family.
Well, ladies, by the time this interview airs, we'll have finished the legislative session, and there's a huge laundry list of things that we needed to address in Wyoming education. And let's just be frank about it. Nothing got done, or very little got done. So where I wanted to take this conversation is, what can parents do? I mean, there's so many things that parents are facing: critical race theory, the LGBTQ agenda, furries in classrooms. I mean, there's a huge laundry list. So what I'd like to ask you is, what do parents do about all this?
Well, we at Parents Defending Education, we have tons of resources to help parents in this process, because it can feel very overwhelming at first for a parent who may not be involved in politics at all to, you know, see this stuff happening and feel sort of helpless. Like, where do you even begin when, you know, they see their child or child's classroom just being barraged with all of this, you know, politically active garbage? So I think the first step is, first and foremost, start asking questions. Reach out to your child's teacher, reach out to their principal, inquire about what's going on in schools. If you don't think you're getting an honest answer from them, you have the right to submit public records requests. You have a right to know what's going on in your kid's classroom. You can do that. We have a resource, a how to file a FOIA request resource on our website that can help. And we're also here to just, you know, listen to parents too and give them advice about their specific situation and how to fight their specific battle. Because, of course, we're seeing national trends across the country with, you know, different things, whether it's race ideology or gender ideology in schools. But schools and education policy is such a local issue. It's a state issue, and then even, you know, more local than that, county-based issues. So we're here to help for, you know, whatever issue parents are facing in their schools, too.
Well, in Wyoming, we tend to have this idea that, well, this is Wyoming. None of that stuff can happen here. And this past year in Sweetwater County, a group of parents got together, and they approached their school board, and they wanted to know about, you know, some illicit books that are in the library, critical race theory, and they were just asking questions. And the school board told them that they don't have a right to know what their children are being taught in schools, and the school board has no intention of telling them anyway. So, Maylene, how do parents deal with school boards that are, in some cases, openly hostile to parents?
I would say, kind of like re-emphasizing what Alex mentioned, that being involved at all levels of what's going on in the school, in your particular school and the district, is really important. And one thing that you mentioned before, that many people are in this kind of like mindset that, oh, this is rural so-and-so, that would never happen here. Or, oh, I don't have children in the school district anymore, that doesn't apply to me. And those are things that have to be, you know, reassessed. Because number one, yes, it is happening all over the country, regardless if we're talking a big metro city area or a rural school district. And number two, whether our kids graduated from the local school district or not, we are taxpayers. We are still paying for those schools and for those administrators' salaries and benefits. So we do have a right to petition and request transparency of what they're doing with our money. In those cases, I would say that, like Alex mentioned before, educating yourself on how to expose and be vocal and speak out about the things that concern you. Again, Parents Defending Education website works as a hub for resources where you can find things from how to write your 3-minute speech to the school board, how to write an op-ed to the local newspaper, how to, which steps to follow if you want to opt out your child from one of these policies or curriculum or classes that you don't agree with because you believe that it's not the proper fit for your family. I think the bottom line in all this, David, is that whether we're talking about curriculum, whether we're talking about pronouns, ideology, books, the bottom line is that we are dealing with a huge group of unelected bureaucrats that are constantly assaulting parental rights because they truly believe deep in their hearts that they know better than us. So we have been called domestic terrorists. We have been called dissenters. We have been called troublemakers. Well, we have news. We're none of those things. We are the parents and we're not going anywhere anytime soon. And the only way that we have to execute that is getting out of our comfy chairs and getting involved in what's going on in the school. Sometimes it might be a conversation with your middle school students. Sometimes it might be reading your 3-minute speech in the school board. Sometimes it might be filing a FOIA request. So how exactly it's going to look is going to be different for each family, for each parent, for each individual. But one way or the other, until we all get together and start speaking out and asking questions, they're not going to get the memo that we are the parents and we are the ones that should have the final say in what is best for our children.
We'll get back to our discussion in just a second. But first, a completely obscene and yet oddly self-serving profit timeout. I know it doesn't seem like it right now, but spring is approaching. Before long, all of those things that came up missing after the first snow, the boat, the motorcycle, the four-wheeler, you are about to be reminded how you left all of them out in the elements, simply because you didn't call Nick and Jesse with Morton Buildings and have a metal structure put up to keep all of them nice and safe throughout the winter months. Yeah, that was kind of short-sighted of you. To prevent all of that from happening again, give Nick and Jesse at Morton Buildings a call. Their phone number is 307-674-2532. They're the experts in metal building construction. They've been doing it longer than anybody else around, and they definitely do it better than anybody else around. So it doesn't really matter what type of metal structure you've been thinking about. Give Nick and Jesse a call. Again, their phone number is 307-674-2532, or you can check them out on their website at mortonbuildings.com. It's Saturday morning, my friends, and you know what I'm thinking about. Hot wings. Hot wings from the Wing It food truck. They make the most amazing wings in the state of Wyoming. And it's not just hot wings. They have several other different flavors. I personally recommend the garlic parmesan wings. They're incredible. Well, the way that you can figure out where that truck is going to be is go to cowboystatepolitics.com and look underneath the sponsors tab and you'll find their schedule there. That way, you can plan your entire week around where that truck is going to be. That's the Wing It food truck. The difference between advertising on traditional radio and on a podcast is on the radio, your customers may or may not hear your message. Because often, the radio is just playing in the background and people really aren't paying that much attention to it. But when your customers download a podcast, they listen to it with intent. So you can be sure that your message will be heard. And you're not going to find a more loyal audience than the one at Cowboy State Politics. So put your advertising dollars where they're actually going to count and shoot me an email. The address is david@cowboystatepolitics.com. I would love to get that conversation started with you. And now, back to the program. Well, here in Cheyenne, which is where we're doing this interview, last year you had a school board that cut down the amount of speaking time at a school board meeting.
And so, you know, parents show up and they, yeah, they have their 3-minute speech, but the school board tells them, well, sorry, you only get a minute to talk. I mean, but those aren't unelected bureaucrats. Those are elected school board members. So, Alex, I mean, what do you do in that situation?
Well, when they're elected, I mean, that shows that first and foremost, you know, you have the responsibility to look at these candidates and elect the right people. And of course, this takes time to dig into, you know, who's there and who your options are. But that is so important because local elections matter the most to you and to your family. And especially in terms of schools, it's your school board that determines what your kid is being exposed to day in and day out. So it's so important that you're getting involved and you know, who the candidates are and what they stand for. And then, you know, the second part of that is holding them accountable. You can say, okay, you ran on, say, parental rights, you ran on transparency, and you're not doing that, you know, in practice. So I think that's really important to, first and foremost, know who you're voting for. Secondly, keep them accountable. And you can do that by continuing to show up at school board meetings. You can do that by continuing to email them and to work with your local you know, parents group to expose what's happening. Also, just reemphasizing and spreading the message that these elections are so important. I don't think the importance of that can be understated.
Okay, let's talk about curriculum for a minute. Now, I'm a historian, and quick story. I had stepkids when I was married, and one of the first things I did is I grabbed my daughter's history book, or my stepdaughter's history book, and looked up a couple things, and the thing was chock full of critical race theory, even before critical race theory was a big deal, before people were paying attention. So my question for you two is, you know, parents are busy, right? They don't have time to sit down and go through an entire history curriculum. What are some things that parents can look for to see if their student is being subjected to critical race theory or LGBTQ type of stuff? Or, I mean, what are some things parents can look for?
So again, I think this is something that Parents Defending Education are, one half of our operation here does really well, is we have different resources on our website. One of them is, you know, woke jargon. So parents can easily kind of read through that and see all of the different terms that are being used to sort of describe the same thing. And that's why, you know, I don't think we always like to call it critical race theory, because, you know, the name can change. Now we're seeing stuff in terms of, you know, social emotional learning, which essentially pushes the education of soft skills like cooperation and whatnot, but through the lens of, you know, equity or anti-racism. So I think it's important that parents understand all of the different types of terms. Again, we have a whole page that kind of walks through all of these different buzzwords. And then if parents see those types of words or concepts in textbooks, in a note home saying, hey, we're going to study this, I think that that page that we have, it's called Woke Jargon, that can help sort of, you know, get you in tune to what should make your alarm bells sound off. If that
I would
helps.
Agree. I think it's a great first step, especially because we're seeing that the more parents are opening their eyes, the more these agendas start changing their name so they can, you know, transform the label. But at the end, the content that is being pushed through the kids, most of the time against parental consent, is the same. And the clear example is with CRT, and now it's being embedded into the social emotional learning, even at elementary school grade levels. It's a big difference. And like Alex said, we have all that information already compiled for parents. We're not talking about the classical education concept of social emotional learning for elementary school kids anymore. We're talking about inserting all these race and equity ideology in soft skills that children this age are not mentally prepared to discuss, especially if their parents do not agree with it. So that would be one great point. And I would say the follow-up or the second step after this would be jump into the resource that has to do with opting out. And the minute that you see a jargon or a word that kind of like raises a red flag for you as a parent, go and submit one of those opt-out forms. Email your teacher and tell them, you know what? I don't want my child to attend social emotional learning. I firmly believe that those soft skills, it's my job as a parent to teach him or her. Can you please give me an alternative activity for them to do? Can they go to the library and read? Can they do additional math worksheets? Can they do extra writing practice? Something like that. Start with your teacher, see what their response is. Then, depending on what you get, you can go to your principal. And if not, you keep following the steps until your child is opt-out from a curriculum and a topic that you as a parent believe is not appropriate for him or her, or simply doesn't match your family needs and belief at that point. I think that that's usually the most effective a way to go, especially when we're talking about elementary school children. So when we're talking about teenagers, middle school, high school, I think that this is such a difficult age for our students that having really open lines of communications with our kids is crucial, because the whole reason why we see them bombarded with all this ideology in this age group is because they know that is the hardest age for them to kind of like come to terms with the family environment and the connections with parents. So I believe that we as parents in those age groups, we really need to be proactive. We really need to be proactive in talking and communicating with the kids about what we believe, about what we think is the best for them and their families, so we're not constantly reacting to the things that they're being pushed in school.
Yeah, and if I can just add one more thing to answer your specific question about, say, divisive race ideology in schools, I think two main ways that we see this, at least right now, is through affinity groups and through any sort of historical teaching that frames history in terms of groups of oppressors and oppressed classes. So affinity groups, I mean, that is when you separate either kids or teachers by race to discuss a certain topic. Separation of anyone by race is racism, and that is unconstitutional. So that's more of a practice that you might not find in a specific history lesson, but a practice that schools might use to discuss a whatever topic. And that's one way that we see divisive race ideology in. And the other way, you know, oppressors versus oppressed classes, this is something you might see in your stepdaughter's history book, right? Of teaching that this certain group, because of their, you know, race, they're victims, and they're even victims now. And I'm sorry, but that is just so dismissive and, kind of patronizing in a way, I guess, to say that people are, you know, you are victims by terms of whatever characteristic you were born as. So I guess to answer that specific question, those are maybe two main ways you might see that in schools today.
And I think that we have had local nearby examples of that will help parents, you know, get an idea of how does that show in real life. For example, we have had neighboring school districts where they implemented mentoring programs for teachers, for new hires, that were based on their race or ethnic group. And then, I mean, in my case personally, as what is considered here a minority woman, I find that insulting. Like, if I am a new teacher, I want my mentor to be the best teacher. I don't care the color of that person's skin, where they came from, or what language they speak. I want the best to mentor me in my profession as a person coming relatively new to it. So that would be one example. Which is kind of like ironic, because we are in a point where people really need to be reminded that segregation during Jim Crow was wrong, and it was immoral, and it's still wrong and immoral today. And it really doesn't matter how many mental gymnastics they do to kind of like tweak that message. It's still wrong, and like Alex says, it's unconstitutional. Another example that usually we see very often, and I hear from parents, mostly with children, students in middle and high schools, is when they have these history classes or social studies classes. We recently have one family that approached us and told us a story about her student having to do I think it was a social study class with an essay that is called Ethnic Hash. And then when the student got all the information in a printout and came home, she came home really upset, because what she read, it was like unbelievable. And then she was crying to her mom, and she's like, Mom, how can I write about this, you know, that this is oppression and that I am oppressed and all that. When you are white, my late father was Latino and my stepdad is black. This essay is telling me that my family is killing me, that it's a disaster. Like, what half of my body, you know, it's the good one, and which is the other one that is the bad one? And putting all these divisive concepts in our students, regardless of the age, is really immoral and it's wrong.
Okay, so the biggest argument against what you just said is that how do you teach history if you can't talk about like racism in the past? I mean, how can you say that, well, you know, racism doesn't exist today if the United States has a history of racism?
Well,
that would be the argument against it.
We absolutely can talk about racism, and I don't think, certainly not us, and no group out there that's advocating for parental rights and for a good education for their kids is saying we shouldn't teach about racism. We should absolutely teach about segregation and the Civil War and even, you know, Japanese internment. Great example of something that's not really taught in schools that we should learn. We should learn an accurate and good telling of history. We should learn about, you know, more Black Americans who contributed great things to our society. We just don't need to teach kids that because of their race, they are different today, that one is better than the other, that one is, you know, a victim and one's an oppressor. I think that's absolutely wrong, like Mylene said, to teach kids today. You can do both. You can improve history. You can learn an accurate, factual American history, and you can do that without telling children that they are good or bad because of their skin color.
Well, and one of the things that I talk about a lot on my program is that we teach history through, and a lot of it isn't necessarily just bald-faced lies. It's lies by omission. The truth is that we had a lot of our founding fathers who were Black, like really, really important people in our history, and we just don't talk about them, you know. And that helps feed the agenda that, well, see, it's always been white and Black. Well, when the truth is, the very first legal slave owner in America was a Black man. You know, the one of my favorite stories is that Paul Revere wasn't riding by himself that night. He was riding with Wentworth Cheswell, who was a very, very prominent Black man in his community. But we don't talk about those people because it doesn't fit our agenda, because the way that we're teaching history really is not history at all. It's called historiography. I mean, it is judging the past by our own preconceptions, and it's not just, here's the facts, judge it on your own. So what's the website parents can go to find out a lot of your resources?
It is defendinged.org. That's the nonprofit C3 website. Like I was saying before, it works more like the repository or the hub for all the resources and information that we have, including what we call the dispatches, which is the sort of like a version of a press release that we put out every time that we complete an investigation with an incident that we have received from a community member or a parent. We also have what we call the heat map. You open that page and you're going to see the map of the entire United States with the colored dots on all those incident reports that we have filed. And using that map, you can also find parents' groups that had already been created in your state, in your area. If there is any parent, anybody in the audience that is thinking, well, I want to join or collaborate with other education advocates or a parent group, that would be a really good first step to go and check how to connect with other people.
Okay, great. Well, is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to talk about before we get out of here?
I mean, this could be an hours-long conversation, but I think we hit some good points. And also for your listeners, you can reach out to us on that same website that Mylene mentioned. Submit your incident reports or just reach out to us if you need help with whatever's going on in your school. Let us know.
And I also would like to, I always like to wrap up these conversations with some sort of like positive note. And I don't know, maybe it's just like the, you know, the optimistic in me, because given that I come from the worst case scenario of all this, I like I like to always focus in the light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that, yes, we do have a marathon ahead of us to reclaim the parental rights and the education of our children. This is not a sprint. All this that is happening in our schools today didn't happen overnight. We're not going to be able to unravel and undo all this in 24 hours either. But I think that parents have reached a point where we're not turning back. We now know what has happened in the past. It's what we call the silver lining of the school lockdowns. And now the parents are getting more educated and more involved in what is happening. I think that it's important to reach out to other parents and other families. I can tell you from my experience dealing with parents and community groups everywhere that sometimes this feels like a very lonely battle, especially because we are dealing with our children. And this is something that is affecting families from all political spectrums. Like, it's this constant whispering of our children that we, the parents and the families, are the enemies, are destroying families regardless of their politics. But at the same time, once that you see that you're not alone, we can kind of like find, like, I don't know, like a sense of community. Like, okay, I wasn't crazy 2 years ago. This happened to somebody else too. Can I help somebody else open their eyes now? And having to start, you know, starting to have those conversations and that sense of community and sharing, I think it's important. Because again, it's, you know, it's our families and our kids, the ones that are at stake. And if we don't do it, nobody's going to do it for us.
That'll do it for today's installment of Weekend Update. Have a good rest of your weekend, and we'll talk again on Monday. But for now, from the base of the Bighorns in beautiful Buffalo, Wyoming, I'm David Iverson, and this is the one and only Cowboy State Politics.